Good morning and welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. It's brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me this week is Dr. Annie Benzi, General and Minimally Invasive Advanced Gastrointestinal Surgeon at Hackensack Meridian Health. Good morning, doctor. How you doing?
Good morning. How are you? Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, we meet again.
Exactly. Round two.
Well, let's start with mentioning that there's a new program at JFK for gastrointestinal reflux and motility. So tell us all about that.
Sure. So the program has just started over the last month, but it's actually been something that we've been working on for the last year or so.
Mm-hmm.
The idea behind this program is to help all patients in our community, in the local Edison area, and also around central New Jersey get better education, information, treatment for their reflux.
So it's focusing only on reflux, specializing.
We also have a separate part of this, which is the motility aspect.
Okay.
It's a little bit more complex. It's actually something that's really under-recognized when we talk about patients that have reflux. They don't realize that they also have an underlying motility disorder. So that's really something that the new technology that we have within our program is now able to elucidate better.
Okay, so we wanted to focus on the reflux, the gastroesophageal reflux disease today. But let's the acronym is GERD, for that long name I just said. I'll say it again: gastroesophageal reflux disease. What is it? And because there's different types.
Yes, there are many different types. So when we say GERD, meaning reflux, what that actually is a term that means passage of contents from the stomach, so from the gastric area, back into the esophagus, which is the food tube area. So things physically moving backwards, you know, kind of like backing up your car in the driveway, going from the driveway to the street, when it really, the thing should be just going from the street to the driveway.
One-way street.
Exactly.
Yeah. What causes that?
So a lot of times it's actually due to an incompetent valve. So at the bottom of the esophagus, before it goes into the stomach, there's something called the lower esophageal sphincter, which is just a valve like any other plumbing valve.
Mm-hmm.
And it's designed to be a one-way valve where the things go down, but very minimal amount should be able to come back up. But for some patients, this valve is just not tight enough. It's too loose, so it's not doing its job in trying to prevent the things from coming back up into the stomach.
I see. So this valve, so to speak, should be preventing anything. Things are always going to try and get back up, but this valve presents that. Even those who don't have reflux, there's always something trying to get back up, but that valve prevents it from happening.
Exactly. So every once in a while, you know, if you eat something too spicy or something that doesn't necessarily agree with you and you feel like the need to throw up, it's actually that valve that opens, so you're able to kind of overcome, you know, the forces of that valve quite easily. But for patients who, you know, constantly throughout their daily life have episodes of reflux, you know, when they're not doing things that kind of provoke that valve, you know, from opening in the opposite direction, that's really the patients that are mostly affected by GERD.
Now, is this something people who have this, or do they throw up more often?
Sure. So they tend to have regurgitation of food, not necessarily vomiting. There are some patients that do have vomiting. But the challenge is really that the food is able to go down, but the force is so high in their abdomen, so that food gets partially digested and then ends up coming out. And that's actually called regurgitation, not necessarily true vomiting.
So it's kind of like when someone says, oh, I just threw up in my mouth.
Usually patients will, you know, actually wake up in the middle of the night and kind of have like almost like a bile-y taste in their mouth. They feel like, you know, there's still something there, like that sensation of something sticking in their chest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually because of this, because things, as they're laying down in bed at night, tend to work themselves through the path of least resistance. And sometimes going through that valve is really the path of least resistance. And that's why people wake up feeling that way.
Now, do you find, and I want to get into, you know, the diagnosis of it, do you find that when patients come to see you, they kind of already know what it is? Or do you find that more patients are coming like, this is what's happening, I don't know what's going on?
So because I'm a surgeon, usually people come to me already with a diagnosis.
Okay.
So they either have gone to their primary care doctor or their gastroenterologist. And most of them have been on proton pump inhibitors. That would be something like pantoprazole, Dexilant. for years and years. And finally, it's gotten to a point where even the medication doesn't help much anymore. So that's when they're kind of at a loss on what to do moving forward. That being said, going back to the motility aspect of this, a lot of patients who come to me don't realize that they have a motility disorder on top of their reflux. So that's the part where I get to, you know, do a little bit more investigating and really make a better diagnosis that can really help determine what kind of treatment they need to have moving forward.
So they're coming to you, they're saying, oh, I think I have this. And then you're saying, well, yes, you do, but you also have this.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The more you look for, the more you will find.
Right. So tell us, so how does the diagnosis occur? What's the process?
Sure. So usually we start with talking with the patient, analyzing their symptoms, looking at the things that tend to trigger these episodes for them, how many pillows they sleep on at night, if they can bend over and touch their toes, and, you know, things tend to regurgitate. And if they've ever had a history of endoscopy with any evidence of esophagitis, which is inflammation or ulceration of their esophagus itself. After that, usually our algorithm includes an endoscopy, which is looking with a camera down the mouth while the patient is asleep. We also do a special test to check the degree of acid within their esophagus.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we need to figure out if there's, in addition to having a loose valve, if there's any structural component to why they have reflux. And that would be primarily a hiatal hernia. So it's a normal opening of the diaphragm muscle. That's the one that helps us breathe. That kind of puts a little extra pressure on that valve that most people have. So if the opening is too high, your valve doesn't have that external pressure, but it also allows for parts of your stomach to go between your chest and your abdomen, and that can actually contribute more to their symptoms as well. So we need to make sure that in, you know, addressing their reflux, that's one of the main mechanical reasons that we rule out. And then in addition to that, we do radiologic testing as well, which is x-rays, using a contrast medium, and that helps tell me about people's swallowing abilities.
And then you decide, I mean, obviously you decide what exam works best, or are all the tests necessary?
So not all of them are necessary. You know, depending on the symptoms that the individual patient is having really does determine what is the best. So if someone has a hiatal hernia and their upper GI, the swallowing test with the the upper GI or the swallowing test with the contrast looks okay,
mm-hmm.
Then we can kind of progress on to the further steps, which really does include surgery. If there's really no mechanical evidence as to why they're having these issues, that's when the further testing is really coming into play, and that would be the acid probe test called the Bravo pH probe, or even manometry, which is the one that tells me a little bit more about the motility of the esophagus or the movement in the esophagus.
Okay, well, let's look at those two. You said the extra testing, the Bravo pH exam. Is that what you said it was?
Yes. So
okay.
It's called the Bravo pH probe.
So that's that's done if all the other tests fail. Is that accurate?
So that's done if patients have no evidence of a large hiatal hernia.
Okay.
That could explain their symptoms.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned that. So how's that? How's that test go? The Bravo test.
Sure. So in conjunction, patients come in just like they would for regular endoscopy. So usually this is patients that haven't had an endoscopy in quite a while. So what myself or you or their gastroenterologist does is actually perform a regular endoscopy. So checking, making sure there's no evidence of inflammation in the esophagus. There's no polyps. There's no other reasons why they're having these symptoms. And then we place a small disposable probe at the end of their esophagus. This probe is actually completely wireless. The procedure ends, and that probe is attached to almost like an old-school pager device that they wear on their hip for about 2 days. And the goal behind this is that every single time they have an episode of symptoms, so nausea, vomiting, regurgitation, reflux, chest pain, they actually hit the button on that probe, and that at that time measures the pH or the acid level in the esophagus, and we get a good correlation to determine whether or not the reason behind their symptoms is actually due to the acid in their esophagus or it's due to some other cause. And then eventually, over time, you know, that little probe will, you know, kind of slough off just like any other skin cell. They'll pass it through. And then the information that we get from that helps us calculate a specific score that can help us determine whether there are surgical or therapeutic options that would benefit that patient.
That's amazing. So you take a little device and attach it to the esophagus. It's not attached to anything else. It's remote. Mm-hmm. On the esophagus, and as you said, they have something that they wear in their hip as like a transmitter. And when they have an issue, they push the button, and then it measures it, and then it just goes away. It doesn't need to be removed surgically.
No, it does not need to be surgically removed. It's actually designed to physically detach itself.
That's amazing.
And then usually it comes out the other end.
How long has this technology been around?
Quite a few years, actually. Yeah, since probably like the mid 2000. It's actually been along for a while. It's becoming more and more prominent as we become more specialized, and people begin to have been on, you know, PPIs, like antacid medications, for over 20 years for whatever reason, and they just keep taking them because that's what, you know, it's helped them in the beginning.
Right.
So not only does it help, you know, myself determine who is a good candidate for surgery, but it also can help gastroenterologists to determine for patients that are having like breakthrough symptoms on these antacid medications, whether or not those antacids are still working. So it actually has a wide variety of uses, not just in, you know, pre-surgical planning.
And yeah, so it's, as you said, it's something that could get someone off of medication that they unnecessarily are taking.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic. All right, so we did the tests, and we come up with a result. I would imagine there's multiple results that you can come up with, but then there's the treatment options.
Of course.
Yeah.
So obviously, we always like to start at the bottom and stack up. So in that initial, you know, consultation with patients, I always make sure that, you know, they're modifying any kind of lifestyle habits they may have that are really contributing to this. The biggest one of this, of course, is obesity. So obesity is really a disease at this point. It's, you know, recognized, you know, as a disease. And unfortunately, one of the aspects of that is that the more intra-abdominal weight that you have, the more pressure you put on that valve that we were talking about before.
Okay.
And that kind of, you know, overcomes the pressure of the valve, and that's why people tend to have more reflux as well. So as part of our program, you know, we do a lot of dietary counseling and modification, and also education for the entire family, because it tends to be not only just that individual patient, you know, but really the family that needs to get on board.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, patients really tend to notice that smoking is a significant contributor. For whatever reason, you know, it really causes relaxation of that sphincter, that valve mechanism,
mm-hmm.
and that can allow for more reflux to occur. So that's something that's modifiable. So trying to get the patient on a plan to quit is really a large part of what we do as well. And then, of course, eating smaller meals, less trigger foods, eating earlier in the evening, so no meals about 4 hours before patients go to bed. And then trying to make sure that they're actually taking their antacid medications as they're prescribed. So when you take antacids in the morning, you actually need to take them on an empty stomach about 30 minutes prior to meals. So what I tell my patients is when you wake up in the morning, when you're brushing your teeth, right after you brush your teeth, you should take your antacids. Don't go and drink your coffee right away. Just give yourself a break, do something else, and then wait for that 30-minute period for antacids to work before you actually start eating. And that tends to make a lot of improvement in some patients as well.
It could be as simple as that then.
Exactly.
Yeah, yep. And that's what they would do moving forward? There wouldn't be any other type of medication or, you know, then we'll talk about the surgery. Any surgery necessary?
So if patients are well controlled with those kind of modifications, they don't have a large parietal hernia, and they feel comfortable just going through a period of observation, that is something that is always an option. However, if they do have hiatal hernias, just like any other hernia, they never get smaller over time by themselves. They only get larger. So in those patients, you know, despite having, you know, some effectiveness from their proton pump inhibitors and antacids, I do strongly counsel them that they do have a mechanical reason as to why their reflux isn't improving.
Mm-hmm.
And those are patients that we usually discuss elective surgical repair of their hiatal hernia. And then also we talk about recreating or making better that natural valve mechanism that we have. And that's something called a fund application.
What is that?
Called a fund application. Recreating the valve mechanism.
I never heard that word before. Surprise.
Surprise, and learning new vocabulary.
Yes. I don't know if I'll ever get to use that again. So fund application. Let me say it again. So you mentioned that sometimes people could just take antacids each morning, as you said, when they brush their teeth. And could that go? Is it okay to just take antacids every day if it works like that for the rest of their life?
So when antacids came out, they were actually originally designed to only be used for 8 weeks. So if patients took them, you know, after 8 weeks and they weren't getting much better, that's when everyone was advised to have an endoscopy performed. So a scope through the mouth just to check and make sure that there was no underlying reason why. So as the data has come out over the years, it's actually been very mixed. But now we know, just like any other medication, everything that you take has side effects. So there are, you know, some serious side effects that come with taking long-term antacids.
Okay.
Those are not, you know, necessarily benign. And what I'm talking about is, you know, kidney disease, osteoporosis, and then, of course, it's just having to take another pill, you know, in addition to whatever medication that you may need to be on for other reasons, high blood pressure, diabetes, and those all do have interactions as well. So the challenge with that is, you know, patients that do have a mechanical reason for the reflux, they'll never overcome that. So those are those patients that have been on that for years and years and years, you know, and they're never really going to get better because the mechanical reason behind the reflux hasn't been addressed. And in those patients, you know, some, you know, do not want surgery and they're willing to, you know, live with some degree of reflux in their lives. But for patients that really are bothered by this, it can become very life-limiting in terms of their quality of life. It's difficult to go out with family. It's difficult to do the sports that they want to do. It's difficult to, you know, even sleep at night, you know. And unfortunately, there are patients that do have, you know, chronic aspiration pneumonia as well because those hernias only get bigger over time. So it's really that patient population where, you know, we can make a significant impact on their life through surgery. Those are really the patients that, you know, we try to encourage to think about more, you know, elective surgical treatment options.
So let's say, you know, that they do get to the point where they do need surgery. How's that performed?
Sure. So what I do is actually offer a robotic. So it's similar to laparoscopic surgery, but it's a stable platform through minimally invasive incisions. So my largest incision is about 8 millimeters, 5 incisions on the belly. Go through the belly from the inside of the abdomen, and actually there's multiple steps in this process. So the first step in what I do, if a patient does have a hiatal hernia, I actually have to reduce that hiatal hernia. And what that means is the parts of the stomach that are within the chest, I have to bring back into the abdomen. So I do that using my little robotic instruments. Go up into the chest and actually move those things into the abdomen. The second part of that is actually fixing the hiatal hernia itself. So what we do for that is sew together those muscles of the diaphragm that are a little bit loose with some special suture, and then put a piece of mesh that kind of reinforces the whole thing. It's not the kind of mesh that you hear about on TV or the radio.
Okay.
Except for today, apparently. It's actually a bioresorbable mesh that will incorporate into your natural tissues over time. And what this actually does is decrease the rate of early recurrence of hiatal hernias.
Okay.
So it doesn't make sense to do a, you know, big, pretty involved operation, even though it's through little incisions, if the hernia is going to recur very early. So that helps me, you know, prevent that from happening. And then the third part of this is, for patients that have normal swallowing ability, I do a recreation of their natural valve. So what we actually do in that fund application operation is to wrap the top part of the stomach around the end of the esophagus and kind of give a bolster to the valve that is already there.
That's amazing.
For patients that do have a lot of swallowing disorders, that's not a part I do. because I don't want patients to have any more issues with swallowing than they started with.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times, just fixing their large hiatal hernia is something that really helps them.
So, oh, wow, that's amazing. And you're doing this all robotically?
All robotically.
Wow. Yep.
The best example, and you know, I try to tell patients, is I actually wrap the top of the stomach around your esophagus as if I'm putting a hot dog in a bun. So that gives you a better idea of
It's kind of like what I pictured.
Being created on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then while patients are asleep during the operation, I actually repeat their endoscopy and check from the inside as well. And I do a couple of things. Number one, I can directly see now that I've made a better valve because I can see the inside of the hot dog bun, so to speak. But I also have a special device. It's called an impedance planimetry probe or catheter. And what this actually does is gives me certain values. And that tells me, you know, before I fix the valve and after I fix the valve, whether or not it's kind of like a Goldilocks position. So I need that valve to be just tight enough where the things don't reflux up. But I can't make it too tight because then things won't be able to pass down either. So not only do you get a robotic surgery, not only do you have the benefit of that recovery, but patients actually have a individual, customized, tailored approach to their fund applications, which I think is pretty cool. And it also gives me the data behind that as well to know who is going to be successful and doing their operations, and gives me a good real-time method to determine, you know, who is going to not have any post-operative issues, and patients who I can make their valve a little bit tighter because I know they have severe reflux. So in the past, we didn't have this. We kind of had almost like a one-size-fits-all approach, but now that we have this new technology, it's something that, you know, patients can get an even greater benefit, you know, from us having it as part of our program.
All right. Well, we only have a couple minutes left. It seemed to have flown by, but I do want to find out what are, for those who may need this and say, nah, I'm not going to bother. I'm good with what I'm doing. What do you say to them? Is there any risks there? Could it get, you know, are their lives in danger if they don't get this taken care of?
So for most patients who have, you know, had reflux for a long period of time, they do actually need to continue to follow up with their gastroenterologist. And the reason why is because although the antacid medications mask the symptoms of that heartburn or chest pain or what they were having, that reflux is still occurring because the valve is still open.
Mm-hmm.
So the gastric acid is, you know, still washing over that part of the lower esophagus, and that can lead to something called Barrett's esophagus. So what Barrett's esophagus is, it's actually a pre-malignant or pre-cancer condition that can then lead to esophageal cancer. It usually takes years for that progression to occur, but the challenge is that patients don't have the symptoms anymore because they've been on antacids for a long period of time, so it kind of goes under the radar, so to speak, until it's picked up by endoscopy. So for patients that, you know, have had reflux for a long period of time, I really do encourage them to continue following up with their gastroenterologist, having scopes on a surveillance basis. You know, if you've been on it for more than 5, 10, 15, 20 years, because you may be surprised to see that you may have changes in your esophagus already. Those changes in terms of Barrett's, that's something that can be addressed. That's not something that will go on to lead to cancer. But, of course, the first challenge, just like any other cancer that we talked about on this program, is that screening is absolutely critical in picking that up before it progresses to cancer. So that would be my caution to patients that do have long-term reflux, is you really need to make sure that, you know, you do have long-term follow-up, even if surgery is not something that you're interested in, because it's something that can really impact your life without you knowing.
Dr. Benzi, thank you so much once again.
Thank you so much. It's lovely chatting this morning.
For more information about the new JFK Reflux and Motility Program, go to HackensackMeridianHealth.org or you can call 732-346-5400. For a podcast of this show, go to FoxSportsRadioNewJersey.com. Thank you once again to Dr. Annie Benzi, General and Minimally Invasive Advanced Gastrointestinal Surgeon at Hackensack Meridian Health. So glad to have her on the program. JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz. Talk to you next week.